Well, hi, this is Dave. Who's already joined?
I'm here, Paula from Brazil.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. And you, David?
I'm great. Thank you. I think for right now, for just a moment, we're the only ones on. Did my note back to you about the workbook, was that, did that make sense and was it helpful? Is it something that would be beneficial to you?
You mean about the workshop that I asked you?
Yes, and the explanation of how to use the workbook and how to create a PDF copy to you know, get around all the shipping costs and all that kind of thing. Was that something that you could see being useful, or were the comments useful overall, or were there other questions?
You know what, David? I just got one email from you saying about the meeting we will have on May the 2nd. That's all I got.
You didn't get my email about your question about the workshop?
No, I didn't.
Okay. I dictated it the next morning, and it would have come like a day after you you sent it. Let me look again and forward it and send it again so that you get it, because I really wanted to respond to you, because I think it's a great possibility that you have for the workshop.
I just found it.
Okay. How soon is the workshop?
It's going to be at the end of May.
End of May. Okay, so you have a month. Okay, you have a little bit more than a month to prepare. See, look at it and see if anything that I offered might be helpful, and if you'd like some other comments on it or anything else that I can do, let me know, because that's a terrific opportunity. Is it something that people are paying to come to?
Yes, but, you know, I haven't given the price yet so far.
Okay, how many
people?
Because
I wanted to
talk
to you before.
I'm sorry, say it again.
I wanted to talk to you before giving any position to them about money.
Look at that and see if it's helpful, and if not, we can have further discussion and I can help you set it up. How many people do you anticipate?
About 15 people.
15? Well, that's terrific. See if you want to do what I mentioned about the workbook and have a co-branded copy. In other words, there are I haven't really explained this very much, but I'll send out some stuff at the end. There are four workbooks that those of you who have completed this training can co-brand. In other words, put your name and coaching firm on the cover and a new first page with a message to clients, contact information, and that sort of thing. And I can get it set up through my graphics person. And that can be by hard copy, or the easiest way to do it, and what I've done just recently, is have my graphics person redesign it so that it's co-branded, it has your brand on the cover, and give you a link to purchase a PDF copy at your rebate at 60% of retail, so that you purchase it, you can send the link for download to your client, they get it immediately and print it out, and you charge them retail. So you've immediately made, you know, $60 or whatever, and your client and everyone for the group, wherever they're located, will have an immediate copy that you can then do assignments for, like the 28-week protocol. Remember on the page that you can play back each of the seminars, one of the links is for a 28-week protocol. That's an example of how to use the workbook and the exercises each week as an assignment for a group or even an individual, possibly, but to use that and have that. That can be compressed or expanded depending on the focus of the group. So look at that and see if it's useful. And if there are other questions, let me know.
Yes, but I need to translate that material, you know. They don't speak English.
Oh, I see. Okay, I have not had it translated. I'm in the process of working with someone to do an entire translation, but I haven't done that yet. I see. So you couldn't use the English version.
No.
Okay. Okay. And that.
But I can. But I don't know if I can translate that. That's up to you because I don't know how is the process that you're having in order to translate this. Are you translating to just what languages are you having this material being translated?
Well, the translation that I'm working on would be to Spanish, but I'm not at a point that is going to be helpful to you. So what are you looking at doing? At just having a few exercises that you translate, or what are you thinking about?
I need your advice. You know, how would you guide me through this?
Well, for right now, what you might do before there's a full translation, you know, your clients are not going to be able to read English.
Yes, they won't.
Okay. All right. Well. I don't have a translation ready. I will in the future, but I don't right now. So, you know, what you might do is just pick a few representative exercises or work tools and translate that yourself as handouts. You know, and all you need to do is just treat it as intellectual property with attribution and reference. But you're free to use that is your license, that you're free to use the material that you're licensed to use that.
You mean the 28-week protocol? Is that what you mean, for example?
You will be licensed to use all the intellectual property, the workbooks, the material, the 28-week protocol, all of that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your question?
Yes, that's my question. And in case I have a group that they have a personal interest, like someone is relationship, this is just a hypothesis. I have people that are interested in relationships, other in money, other in writing a new story. How can I deal with that difference of objectives?
Well, there are four workbooks that are right now all in English. Roadmap for a New Wellness Story, which is the roadmap plus the wellness module. Your New Money Story, which is the Roadmap 3 modules plus the New Money Story. There's one that's the entire workbook that is the whole New Life Story, all the 10 modules. But none of those right now are translated. So I guess right now it's not useful for you. I'm in the process.
But if I could have that workbook, I could, I guess, choose some exercises. Or do I have all of them in my workbook?
I am going to be sending to each of you my compliments, the client workbook, at the end of the training. I'll go ahead and do that now. But just know, though, that everything that's in the workbook, the client workbook, is in your curriculum in gray. Notice at the beginning, there's an explanation that everything that's in the workbook is in your curriculum in gray, so that, you know, with a gray background, so that you get an idea of where the suggested use or application is. But I'm going to send each of you, as my compliments, the separate client workbook, so you get an idea of what it would be like for your clients to use that. But now, in South America, I can't tell you how long it'll take to get there. You know, I can expedite it, but it still may take a while and not be in time for it. But the material is in the curriculum.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Sounds good. I think I will have enough to start.
Okay.
With
okay,
this
great
material that you've said you're
going to. Congratulations on the, you know, the how things are evolving for you with the group. That sounds like a terrific application, and however I can help, let me know. Well, let me check in with others. Is Emily here? What about Robin? Okay, Carla, we're it today. Anything else you want to discuss, or any questions or challenges that have come up with clients?
Yes, there is one question I have for you, is that when we are working with relationship, if the couple would like to write a new a new story for their relationship, would they do that together?
You would do that with them as your client. If they're coming together, then your client is the couple. And
right.
The writing a new story, that's the metaphor. That's the description of what you're working on with them and doing with them. So
mm-hmm.
while they may not be literally, taking a yellow pad and writing a new story, that's the process that you're going through with them. And the metaphor to describe understanding the aspects of their story of revising and creating new ones. So as a relationship coach, you're working with them to create a new and revised story for their relationship. So
like the roadmap?
That would be one way to do it. That the roadmap, this is simply to inform you. Now, you may not go through each of those seven steps with them, although you may. I don't know. It depends on if how you want to work. I mean, this is really to inform you, but if you want to give them the roadmap and give them some exercises or suggestions, you can certainly do that.
Okay.
And it would be that, when you're working with a couple, the couple itself is your client, not two individuals, but the couple. When you're working with a group, the group is your client, and you're working to facilitate the process of the group. It's not like mm-hmm. having eight individuals as your clients, but the group is your singular client, and you're facilitating the process of the group to have that evolve in a way that you apply your coaching skills and principles to that.
Okay, same got it. Couple. Thank you.
Make sense?
Makes sense, totally. Yes, absolutely.
Great.
Thank you.
Anything else that would be helpful to discuss?
No, for the time being, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead with our material today. This is our next to last session, and I'll explain more about what we were talking about next time in terms of what to look for after this. And you each received an email from me about the mentor group that's once every quarter, and it's all the people who have done the training. There's a white paper each time. We'll discuss a number of things, best practices, use the group as a mastermind group, share successes about what people have done that may be helpful for other people as kind of a catalyst. It's a one-hour group once every quarter at 1 o'clock Eastern, and I think you'll each find it beneficial. So today we're going to look at Module 9 at Live Your Success Story, and I want to add some things and look at an application of some of the things in the curriculum. The brain is a really efficient machine, doesn't waste energy. Simplicity is to take the path of least resistance, to use neurons already familiar with the task. The brain inclines toward repeating the old story. And this is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, as we've discussed, by early experience, and then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're really circuitous routes. When a client is resistant, don't take it personally. They're frustrated, too. They're in this groove automatically. They're in a groove. Together, you can create a path. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, new context, which is exactly what we do in mentor coaching, and that's what asking questions and appreciative inquiry is about. So let's talk first a little bit about decision clarification. Researchers Steve Booth Butterfield and Bill Rager from West Virginia University devised a study to look at visually depicting choices, making choices that we make graphic to really visualize them. The study ran ads indicating that one glass of whole milk has the same amount of saturated fat as five strips of bacon. At a press conference, they showed reporters a tube full of fat, the equivalent of the amount of a half gallon of whole milk. By making a healthy choice specific and tangible, the market share of low-fat milk moved from 18 to 41%. They moved eating healthily from kind of an abstract notion and an admirable goal to a specific choice and behavior. So when you want to help a client affect change, you need to help them script specific behaviors to affect change in others and enhance active decision-making for clients. Limit and specify clear options, because change always has to begin at the level of individual decision and specific behaviors. Here are some of the leading reasons that people resist change. So understanding these reasons can be an initial step for the mentor coach. One is ambiguity aversion. People avoid ambiguous situations. The risk of change is seen as greater than the risk of standing still. Sort of like better the devil you know than the one you don't. People prefer a known risk to an unknown risk, even if the known risk is high. To make a change requires a leap of faith. It's a move in the direction of the unknown and the unexpected. You have no proof. Another, people feel connected to other people identified with the present situation. Change threatens losing those identified with the old way. This resonates with emotional bonds of loyalty as well as individual status quo and group inertia. And there may be no new role models for the new activity, or at least mentors who have been there before. To surpass those who have been both mentors and colleagues is challenging. You can't know you have competence for a new situation that you've never been in before. Now, this may be subtle, but it's a pervasive fear that people are concerned they won't be able to make the transition well. And finally, the proposed change threatens not only people's notions of themselves, but also how they're perceived by others and whether others will respond with support or a competitive jealousy. So we just don't know how people will respond, so that makes it a little bit off-putting as well. So narrow the choices, make them specific, time measured, decide what good enough is, and a narrow choice to fit a specific goal. And a caveat now, always consider whether the proposed change is a good idea or a bad idea. Sometimes focusing on the dynamics of change and the transition process can blur clear judgment about whether it's really a good idea that needs to be fully engaged, especially those who automatically see change as a challenge to be engaged or even idealize change may not really carefully consider this enough. So let's talk a little bit about change and transition, this process itself, because this is ubiquitous for every client you will work with as they navigate and negotiate aspects of change and transition. So the change is the event. It's a situation. You change a behavior, you move to a new city, have a baby, take a new job. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals. The transition is the process. It's the internal story of change, a shift in orientation, even of self-definition, or there wouldn't be a P in roadmap. Transition is attention to the seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. We help clients create change and embrace transition to let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve to the new story. There are four basic elements of transition that may be helpful to consider, just for your conceptual awareness as a coach. One, every transition begins with an ending. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, habitual routines in order to establish new patterns. Never underestimate the need and the power of letting go. To move to a new position, you have to relinquish a past one. To do things a new way, you have to end the way you do them now. To become something new, you have to give up some of the old self. And to transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Second, people in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. We've talked a lot about the mind and brain reasons that change is difficult and how to facilitate that change. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. This is a crucial juncture in coaching. We help a client conceptualize this as an expectable part of change and transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. And you might consider reframing this return to the familiar with a client as perhaps a way of measuring progress, a validation of moving ahead, and to be sure that you both believe. And third, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. Remember, we talked a number of times that if you engage in any change or any behavior that's different, unless you address transitioning or transforming your identity along with that change, the operating model of who and how you are, you'll revert to the familiar. That's the most powerful force of the human psyche. We revert back to our core identity. So that has to evolve as a model that's in transition along with the changes you make in behavior. And consider, too, that the impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance to the significance of the change that caused it. Now, this can be confusing at first. Somebody can be discombobulated by a seemingly minor illness because it shatters an illusion of invulnerability. Or another person can take the loss of a parent in stride, but yet then be devastated by the loss of their dog. It's kind of like they're one tragedy behind. And the fourth, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system. Your family, your company, it's their self-statement of reaction to change, an attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change. Jung said, the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. So, to consider the notion of pre-commitment for just a minute. We talk about commitment in coaching, but I want to back that up one more step and look at pre-commitment and give you an example of that. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He's been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desires, because he knew that willpower alone might not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation. So pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses. Pre-commitment involves present planning and action against the strength of a future desire, either by taking certain options off the table or making them prohibitively costly. And let's talk then about commitment devices. As we think about being an accountability partner in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors that they know are in their best interest. Think about how we help our kids do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response include some alcoholics take antabuse, a pill that makes you sick if you drink. Others do gastric bypass surgery to prevent overeating. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for 3 papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Now, think about this. 100% of students always have the option of creating their own earlier deadlines. They can determine that wherever and whenever they want to. But when it was official and they were offered this option by the professors, 75% said yes. This was for a compulsive spender, freezing a credit card in ice. This is something that she indicated to me that she did in response to a blog of mine that she saw. And a final one, people find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at the Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products and should products, things they wanted but didn't need, and then things that they needed. They would devise ways to either put off either purchasing or receiving delivery on the want products to ensure that they would do what they needed to do first. We can collaborate with clients to construct commitment devices to do what's in their best interest. For example, to prioritize shoulds and reward with wants reframes the wants as part of a performance ethic. This is a kind of a contingency that can remove guilt from what you both know you're going to do anyhow. And planning is a different scenario than impulsivity. So let's look now at the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new story, because I think this can be helpful for helping someone craft success by looking at what are the most common mistakes, because that can inform as well. 1, not knowing that you don't know. Now, how can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. To know to ask is half the answer. And the answer here is to develop self-reflection. And that's something that I think is essential in our work with clients, in helping them develop the capacity for self-reflection. There were a couple of studies in recent Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind about how self-reflection is an essential aspect for success for executives. 2, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this may be a correct strategy, but it can also stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So we may ask, and then what? Or what else? I'll introduce number 3 with this brief quiz. 5 frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. 4, however, planned their strategy and then decided they would jump off. How many were left on the log? Well, 5 were left because they only planned and decided they didn't commit to act. Number 3 is procrastination. Now, for procrastination, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns, putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We have little sense of urgency, which can contribute to a lack of focus. When the 2-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. This imminent deadline, a limited finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases efforts. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but may not internalize fully. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Number four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths and limitations, your biological cycles, biorhythms, when you perform best. So, some things to consider here. Know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which state works best for each particular task. For example, writing and editing, two very different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at two different times. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind, like running errands, because shifting between one state and another takes a good deal of energy. Identify what enhances your energy. Anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. Identify what depletes your energy. Toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. Fifth mistake that people make, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what your options are or which ones are even available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. What looks like resistance can be simply a lack of clarity about what to do next. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear rather than vague or absent. Eat a healthier diet or save for the future is both vague and abstract. When you want to change, let me put that in a different way. When you want to affect change in others, to help them change, help them specifically script behaviors. When you want to enhance active decision-making for clients, help them limit and specify clear options, a next best action. Change always has to begin at the level of the individual decisions and specific behaviors. Number six, too many choices. Some studies have shown how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many choices, and the extra options can backfire, leading to decision paralysis. Many investment options of different kinds of stock and bond funds, real estate investment trusts, various market funds, both international and domestic, including money market accounts, are usually offered as options. And each category has several choices within it. For every 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by 2%. At some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and someone reacts to the default mode to not make a choice. A classic study in decision paralysis was done at a gourmet grocery store. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. On an alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. For both of the weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. While the larger display of jams attracted more potential customers, in both cases, people tasted an equal number of jams. When there were 24 varieties available, 3% purchased. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchasers. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the willingness to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion, can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business, publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Perseverance, and this is from Lord Eliot, and it's a very succinct statement. Perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. And the eighth, not following success trails. Have you said some version of following? Well, I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not quite sure what it is. I want to create wealth, but I don't have a plan. First, decide how you want to expand. Then, pick success trails to follow. When a very good buddy of mine, Art, heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and had completed my professional coach training, he came to Houston to take me to dinner. He mentioned, as I knew he had done a transition from a senior executive position at IBM a number of years earlier, at a very early retirement from IBM to form his own consulting firm, he chose five very successful people and asked them to lunch or dinner to pick their brains about what he was about to do, and he advised me to do the same. It worked for both of us. Some international business people with instant global recognition pick his brain for substantial picking fees. So, create a support team, construct an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor coach, join a mastermind group. One thing, and interrupt if there are any questions or comments. Any thoughts or any questions or any clarifications at this point? Well, I'll move on. I want to mention something especially about adaptation to success. I want you to consider this. Success is never final, so it's important not to get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story, told with your voice. Keep a growth mindset, an open mind to what's working and what's not working. One reason to be very clear about your needs and your ideals and to have a clear idea of your story is to deal with success. It's at least as challenging, I think more so, to deal with success as it is with adversity or scarcity. My prediction, each of you will have a new level of success that you haven't had before, so be ready for it. The writer F. Scott Fitzgerald had just completed his novel, This Side of Paradise. He was riding high, a successful writer in every aspect. He had just married a beautiful wife, had a storybook life. Then Fitzgerald said, "Riding in a taxi one afternoon between very tall buildings, I began to cry. I had everything I wanted, and I knew I would never be so happy again." The problem, he felt, is that every story must end. And for a writer, that was always true. He then descended into depression and alcoholism and died a very early death. Elvis became the story of success, but it wasn't that story that brought him success. But he identified with the success story and lost himself in it. His true story ended as he lay cold on the bathroom floor at age 42, full of drugs and the trappings of success. Two guys who needed mentor coaches not to become successful, but to deal with success. Failure and success are both stories, external stories about events, meaning you have to continue with efforts and change in order to sustain success. Either story, failure or success, can change. It can continue, grow, or end. To continue with a success story is to continue doing that which created the success. After you arrive at success, you can't stop doing the things that created the success and only inhabit the success story, the things things having to do with success and its enjoyment, in other words. Soon then, success will wither and the story change. You can become defined by the story. So it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. So another aspect of adaptation to success is to occasionally bring to the foreground and re-examine your why. Why do you get up in the morning? If you don't want to get up, reflect on what will create challenge, satisfaction, creative effort and pleasure, and passion, as well as achievement. Remember that immobilization and distress can be created by three things. One, prolonged planning. Ready, aim, 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 versus ready, fire, aim. Now, I'm not advocating doing things prematurely, but to make it an organic process, to plan, to begin, to reevaluate, adjust, do more, and make it a process of continuing by examining what you do, seeing what works and doesn't, and revising as you go forward. Another that can create immobilization, continuing to align yourself with the universe. Ultimately, very mellow can be compromised by very poor. And third, wish boards and repeating daily affirmations without taking action. Remember my grandmother, the critic of The Secret, 5 decades ahead of her time? Her version of this is, wishes don't wash dishes. Now, common to each of these three is a need for a plan to be coupled with action. So let's examine a concept we've considered some time ago just to see how far we've come. Creating a new belief. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often that they actually achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it often and in every way that you can. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. Here's a story about the importance of belief. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1960 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors. But he priced his at 5 cents, and the other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior. They attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. That just furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handworker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes. And he raised his prices. They began selling very well. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food, it had to be good. His hot dogs became a national phenomenon, Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs. And even now, exactly 100 years later, those are still sold throughout North America. I don't think they're in South America, but they're sold throughout North America, Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Now, creating a new belief is not usually an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take a period of time. It can be planned, though, step by step with an incremental progress. And it takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anybody else's. Don't compare your inside to anyone else's outside. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. And you can always know the difference between procrastination and dosing, timing, and titrating. In other words, between putting things off and planning well. And that can be a huge distinction to keep in mind. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind and your brain. The choices generate the moment-by-moment life you create. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, determines how it will be. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. Genes, experiences, and focus. DNA downloads inform from the expression of its code. We now know that it also goes in the other direction. Our experiences, our beliefs, can actually turn genes on or turn them off to determine a major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. Dr. Bruce Lipton summarized this finding, emphasizing that genes can't turn themselves on or off, but adapt to our beliefs and experiences. And here's the last note on beliefs and the resulting attribution of value. On a January morning during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin in a subway station in Washington, D.C. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces composed for the violin, Bach's Sonatas and Partitas for Unaccompanied Violin. 1,097 people walked by. He was barely noticed, just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. His name? Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who rarely performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin, a $3.5 million Stradivarius. In this study by the Washington Post, the D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attributed to Bell's performance was based on their perception. Value attribution is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even if it's worthy of our attention. Then, the value we assign shapes our perception. So, let's talk about the correct paradigm. This is something I think we may not often enough talk about in professional coaching, is how the correct paradigm needs to be the frame around something, because the frame determines the meaning, and if it's not the correct framework, we're going to be misled or to mislead ourselves. Here's a brief story that sort of illustrates this. One night on a camping trip, Sherlock Holmes wakes up Watson and says, "Look at the stars, Watson. What do you see? What do you deduce?" Watson thinks for a minute and he says, "Well, I see millions of stars, many of which resemble our sun, which most likely have their own planets, which most likely have life forms like us. So I deduce that there is life on other planets." And Sherlock said, "Nah, you idiot, somebody's stolen our tent." Now, consider each of these paradigms as a conditioned response to certain stimuli. You'll hear derivatives of some of these belief systems from your clients as they move with you toward becoming their own authority. One, genetic determinism. The genes are doing it to you. It's an inherited trait fashioned by long-standing DNA copy. I can't help it. If you're Irish, it adds to your temper. Psychic determinism. Your parents did it to you. Environmental determinism. Your boss or your spouse or the economy is doing it to you. The antithesis of each of these paradigms of determinism is an internal point of reference. The mastery of writing your own story, of being your own authority. remember this. What remains unconscious will likely later emerge as fate. Our fears are not made fully conscious until we let go of our dreams. Mastery takes time. Don't skip any steps. Decide what you want to measure in order to achieve your goals. You have to measure what you want more of. What I hear over the PA system every time I'm in LA Fitness, every afternoon when I'm working out, what gets measured gets improved. All problems have exceptions. A research team focusing on families, this was a very well-known research team in the West Coast area of the United States. And what they did was to take the families who came in to formulate the issues that they came in with to focus on solutions rather than problems, because the usual and traditional approach was to look at and explore and look at the dynamics of all the problems. And what they did then was to look with this family at possibilities, but especially to look at, was there a single time that this problem didn't exist? And what they did then was to look at the time the problem didn't exist was the solution. So exceptions can be the times when problems would have happened but somehow didn't. So instead of focusing on the details of the problems, the research team paid attention to how the exceptions occurred. The details of who, what, where, when were focused on the exceptions rather than the problems. The results were that changes occurred more quickly and more pervasively than the traditional approach. The energy placed into the problem and understanding the problem gets placed into the exception, which is to say the solution. When non-problems are created, it absorbs the energy for the problems. So this means that from our clients, it may be helpful to find out these things. What has worked in the past? When is it the client feels calmer? When does the client feel more peaceful, more confident? When has the client experienced mastery? How can the client conceptualize effective strategies? So let's look now at a new operating system. Let's revisit the notion of operating systems. I'm looking at this whole notion for this module about living a success story and enhancing that. You're aware of how computers have operating systems. Within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex system of software that contains instructions, protocols, couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Usually, we only think about the operating systems when there are problems or failings. Our society also has operating systems of laws, customs, social and economic arrangements that comprise protocols and assumptions about how we conduct ourselves. Let's use the example of your money story. It has a similar operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions about your behaviors as other stories do, but yet there's some specificity. There are various theories and disciplines that each have perspectives on this system of human behavior that ultimately downloads as your own story so that you tweak it to make it uniquely yours. Now, consider these downloads that operate smoothly within a system but don't work. That is, there's no failure in the operating system, but the downloads are faulty. This is simply known as glitches in the wisdom of creating wealth. Here are some examples. Thinking that if you're not born with money, you'll never have money. Equating education with an entitlement to wealth. Assuming that book smart will make you street smart. Focusing on rich and forgetting about wealth. Focusing on making and spending money rather than on making your money work for you. Not seeing yourself capable of making a lot of money results in not making a lot of money. Waiting for motivation in order to generate the energy and personal business plan to succeed. or simply expecting things to happen really quickly. Your money story is a paradigm to understand your relationship with your life story. Your fundamental beliefs, assumptions, convictions, and personal truths about money are generally the same ones you have about life. If you get behind in your paperwork in your life, you're likely to get behind in your financial paperwork. If you put off doing necessary things that will reap a benefit later, you'll probably be doing the same thing with long-term savings and retirement. To find out what you believe about your life, the fundamental convictions that you have, the ultimate truths you hold, look to your money story. Remember the subtle, pervasive influence of the status quo. The status quo can masquerade as the blessing of being Sisyphus. As long as you struggle to push the boulder up the mountain, almost but never actually arriving, you're always certain of your focus and your work. You always have something specifically to do. This translates to always knowing who you are, someone trying hard at something but never quite getting there, someone with a weight problem who always has to work hard but never quite gets to that ideal weight, someone who's always about to do well and become debt-free and make really big money, almost. But because of this, you're never lost, you're never helpless, because there's always this specific elusive goal that has even perhaps become part of an identity. You can rewrite your new programs in your mind. Then they can be repeated until they become automatic. So what I want to do is close with two things: to look at life stages of success and then do a final exercise. For the life stages of success, this is really about moving beyond the wide-angle lens to more like time-lapse photography, because success may mean something that's different or different things at different points in adult life, at each developmental phase. So here are ways that we can look at that, and I'm going to just give you a quote for some of these different junctures or perspectives, because it summarizes so much and more than I could with many, many more words. Here's how it may look in a relationship, and this is from Ruby D., I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic, hopefully. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important. Or, ideally, before and achieve faster and more profound success. A caveat: be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's one final one, that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, here's a final exercise I'd like you to do. I'd like you to get in a really relaxed position. Take a deep breath of relaxation in and breathe out any tension. Take another deep breath in and breathe out all your tension. Close your eyes and focus just on my voice. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now from your 90-year-old self. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should have taken. Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are and who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. We have some time for discussion, you know, kind of gradually open your eyes and think about if there are any questions or comments or things that you'd like to talk about, either from the material or from clients or your reading. Paolo, anything at all from what we talked about? If there are no questions, we'll do a wrap a few minutes early, and if there are any things that come up or any questions that you have, shoot me an email, and we'll cover them at the beginning of the next seminar, our last one, and or jot them down, and we'll cover them at the beginning of our next seminar. So thanks very much, and I look forward to picking up with you here next time for our final seminar.
Okay.
Bye now. See you.
Bye-bye. See you.